Welcome to our big question evening. How can you say there's only one true faith? How can there be just one true religion? Asked Siobhan. It's arrogant to say your religion is superior and try to convert everyone to it. Surely all religions are equally good, equally valid for meeting the needs of their followers. Such a view has an immense attraction. It avoids the black and white choice and sees everything in shades of grey. It seems very respectful, giving a legitimate place to other people's views. It seems very modest and humble, not making arrogant claims for one particular religion. It seems so reasonable, so logical. We take into account the views of everybody and try to build up an identikit picture of God. It is today a view which is widely supported. Some influential people, the likes of Mahatma Gandhi. The soul of religions is one, but it is encased in a multitude of forms. Truth is the exclusive property of no single scripture, he said. Our own politicians, of whatever colour, faced with the threat of Islamic terrorism, have sought to discourage exclusive claims. Through education, through the promoting of British values, they want us all to admit that each religion is just one amongst many, equally valid ways to live. But dig a bit deeper, and that attitude is not the respectful, humble, and logical approach that it first appears. In fact, I'm going to suggest to you that it's quite the opposite. The view that all religions are equal paths to the truth is often illustrated by an ancient Hindu parable. The parable tells of a group of blind men describing an elephant. One man touches its trunk and compares it to a snake. Another feels its ear and compares it to a fan. The third man places his hand on the elephant's leg and says it's like a tree trunk. A fourth pushes on the elephant's side and insists it's like a wall. The fifth man holds the tail and finds it like a rope. And the last man feels a tusk and declares that the elephant is like a spear. Now, the story of the elephant seems to offer a humble approach to different religions. Each religion has got hold of part of the truth, but none can see the whole. But hang on a minute. There is one person who is claiming to see the whole, the narrator of the story. Other people can see parts of the truth, but they alone know that it's actually an elephant. They say each religion sees part of the truth, but none can see the whole. But they themselves are implicitly claiming to see the whole. You can only say each one sees only a part because you think you can see the whole. So an approach which seems humble is in fact arrogant, claiming a superior kind of knowledge, just the sort of knowledge which it says no religion can have. The story of the elephant seems respectful, giving a place for each religion. But it isn't. It's actually a patronising approach, insisting that the detail of what each religion believes, it doesn't really matter too much, not respecting them enough to take those beliefs seriously. A Christian minister, a Jewish rabbi, and a Muslim imam were all members of a panel discussing the differences between their religions. And they each affirmed that there were significant differences between their faiths. For example, concerning the person of Jesus, they all agreed to this statement. If Christians are right about Jesus being God, then Muslims and Jews fail in a serious way to love God as he really is. But if Muslims and Jews are right that Jesus is not God, but rather a teacher or prophet, then Christians fail in a serious way to love God as he really is. They were showing each other the respect of taking each other's beliefs seriously. To say that all religions are much of a muchness is disrespectful to each one of those religions. Conversely, to say, I believe you are wrong, need not be disrespectful or unkind. A theology professor once put it like this. It's often said that you should respect other people's beliefs, but that's wrong. What is vital is that you respect other people. Indeed, think about it more closely. And attempting to persuade someone to change their beliefs is not disrespectful. It's actually a mark of respect. It means that you're treating them as thinking agents, with the ability to decide what they believe, not just products of their cultural conditioning. So we shouldn't be offended when people challenge our beliefs. We should be flattered. They're treating us with respect. In today's cancel culture, we seem to be losing the art of open disagreement and robust debate. Instead, we only allow people who think like us. Certainly, such debate can be done in a way which is disrespectful, can be rude and insulting. But such debate does take people's beliefs seriously enough to disagree. It's a mark of respect. It means that we're ready to have our own beliefs tested and challenged. And if we think our beliefs have life and death consequences, then it's loving to try to persuade others. The story of the elephant seems to be logical, but actually it's profoundly illogical. It's a nice sentimental idea to suppose that all religions are basically one, but it flies in the face of all the evidence. The beliefs of different faiths are not complementary, but contradictory. The God of Hinduism is plural and impersonal. The God of Islam is singular and personal. The God of Christianity is the creator of the world. The divine in Buddhism is not personal and not creative. You could scarcely have greater contrasts. Christianity and Islam are both monotheistic. There is only one God. But ask a Muslim what Allah is actually like, and it soon becomes clear that he is very different. The thing that is most often emphasized about Allah is that humans cannot really know what he is like. We're told that he acts in certain ways according to his own will, like sending both good and evil into the world. But he is quite beyond human knowledge. He's so far above us that it's impossible for people to relate to him in a personal way. The idea that he might reveal himself to humans is simply out of the question. Well, what a contrast to Christianity. What would be blasphemy to a Muslim is actually a central belief of Christianity, God in human form. Look at those differences, and we have to say they can't all be true. They can't even be different ways of describing the same thing. No disinterested onlooker would say they're describing the same reality. God can't be many and one at the same time. He can't be unknowable and yet at the same time fully reveal himself. Now, I'm not wanting to evaluate those different beliefs at this stage. I just want to show how utterly illogical it is to say that they're all pointing in the same direction. It's as foolish as saying all roads out of Manchester lead to London. They do nothing of the sort, and it's not helpful to pretend that they do. To say that the soul of all religions is one just does not make sense. But I want to go further. Not only is it illogical to suppose that all religions lead to God, it is frankly impossible. Two reasons why it's impossible for us to find God through whatever religion you care to mention. First is the nature of God. If there is a God, he is the source of humankind and our environment. He's the Lord over all religions. human life. One bit of the Bible, Isaiah chapter 40, says this. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales, and the hills in a balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord, or instructed him as his counsellor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge, or showed him the path of understanding? How can anyone possibly climb up to God? How can the cup understand the potter who made it? Man cannot find God, however hard he searches. If by religion we mean man's search for God, then all religion is bound to fail. We get some hints from creation, from our sense of right and wrong, but those hints don't get us very far. In fact, they make us realize how vast the gulf the creature cannot possibly discover the Creator. That's one reason why all religion is bound to fail. But there's another reason too. Not only the nature of God, but also the nature of human beings. The fact is that we're not the earnest lover of God that we like to think we are. The Bible tells us that we are not the impartial seekers after truth we like to imagine. On the contrary, we suppress the truth. We do not follow every gleam of light that comes our way. On the contrary, Jesus said, men love darkness rather than the light because their deeds were evil. How do we know that? Well, if we were all good at heart, all earnest seekers of the truth, then surely we would flock to Jesus, the best there's ever been. But left to ourselves, we don't. We hide from him, actually. People might claim to be seeking God, but it is always God on their terms. God as they want him to be. So no one has ever arrived at the true God, because he is too great. And because we are too twisted, too self-centered to want to do so. And those are two massive barriers to supposing that all religions lead to God. The reality is that no religion leads to God. In that impossible situation, then, there is only one hope. We cannot reach up to God, but there is no reason why he should not reach down to us. Suppose for a moment you were God. The people you've made have turned their backs on you. They don't want to share their lives with you. What might you do? Well, you might choose one individual and work on him and his descendants. God did that. His name was Abraham. He trusted God, obeyed God, became the father of the Jewish nation. But that nation strayed from the path Abraham had trodden. What was to be done? Perhaps a time of hardship in a foreign country might make them come to their senses. That's what Israel's time in Egypt was all about. And later the medicine was repeated in Babylon. You might raise up prophets to call the people back to yourself. God did just that, but they did not listen. Finally, if you cared enough, you might come in person, a sort of summit visit, after your staff had prepared the way. Well, the claim of Christianity is that God has done exactly that. For the best part of 2,000 years, the way had been prepared. And then Jesus steps into human history. No finite mind can reach up to the infinite, but there's no reason why the infinite can't stoop down to the finite. A bit of the Bible says this. In the past, God spoke through the prophets at many times and in various ways, but in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son. He has come in person. At long last, people could see God. They could hear God. As one of the eyewitnesses writes, No one has ever seen God, but the only begotten one, God himself, has made him known. If you've read one of the Gospels, you may well have been struck by a remarkable contrast. On the one hand, Jesus is a humble, self-forgetful figure, a carpenter's son from a remote village. But on the other hand, he makes the most outrageous claims. Many of them almost casual throwaway remarks. For example, he takes for granted that he is entitled to the worship of others, the worship due to God alone. Peter falls at his feet. Thomas does the same, saying, "My Lord and my God." Jesus doesn't say, "Don't be silly." He accepts it. And then there are the direct claims. "Anyone who's seen me has seen the Father," Jesus said. "If you're looking at me, you're looking at God." And then there are the actions by which he claimed to be God in the flesh. That claim which both Jew and Muslim hold to be blasphemous. One of my favourite examples. Jesus was in teaching in a house so packed that no one else could squeeze in. Four men dig a hole in the roof to get their paralysed friend in front of this healer. Jesus looks at the man and says, "Son, your sins are forgiven." The religious leaders are outraged. "Why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" They were theologically correct. Only God can forgive sin. And then Jesus proves that he has the authority to do so by telling the paralyzed man to get up in front of everybody, doing what only God can do. So yes, he had that right to forgive sin, because he was God in the flesh. At this point, listen to these words of C.S. Lewis. "There is no halfway house, and there is no parallel in other religions. If you'd gone to Buddha and asked him, 'Are you the son of Brahma?' he would have said, 'My son, you're still in the veil of illusion.' If you'd gone to Socrates and asked, 'Are you Zeus?' he would have laughed at you. If you'd gone to Muhammad and asked, 'Are you Allah?' he would have first rent his clothes and then cut off your head." Time and again, the Gospels record Jesus doing outrageous things that only God can do. Commanding the wind, forgiving sins, feeding the multitudes, raising the dead. He presents himself not as one possible option, but as God in the flesh. The revelation from God that we need if we're ever to know him. You can choose to disbelieve him, but he cannot be one truth among many. He's not left us that option. And his coming had a second purpose. Not only that revelation of God that we desperately need, but even more basic, a rescue by God that we desperately need. He shows us what God is like by his incomparable life. But more basic than that, he comes to put us right with God by the rescue of his death. All other religions are very different. Most of them revolve around the idea that you get right with God by your own effort. And if that effort is great enough, then maybe there's a chance you'll get there. Take Buddhism, for example. The Buddha said that if God existed at all, he wasn't in the business of helping anyone to achieve the goal of enlightenment. It was up to the individual to make the effort. If the evil desires which result in pain and suffering can be overcome, then that person may achieve nirvana. The Hindu goal is also called Nirvana, but it means something rather different. It means being reunited with Brahma. But again, the individual can only achieve it by their own effort, through the continual cycle of reincarnation. Whether you go up to a higher life form or down to a lower life form is decided by how good you are in the life you live, all determined by the law of karma. What you sow in this life, you reap as reward or punishment in the next. But Christianity is completely different. In contrast to every other religion, it says that acceptance by God is not something to be achieved. Indeed, it cannot be achieved. Rather, it is simply to be received. Not a ladder to climb, but a rescue to receive. Completely different. And let me suggest to you that it's far more realistic. It faces up to the fact that I can't live up to my own standards, let alone God's. It's also far more reassuring, wonderfully reassuring, that God, in his immense mercy and love, took responsibility for my failures and laid them on the shoulders of Jesus when he died on the cross and guaranteed that rescue when he rose from the dead. The Bible emphasizes from start to finish that was the very purpose for which Jesus came into our world. The cross of Jesus is the place where you and I can be rescued by God. There's nothing remotely like it in any other religion of the world. And again, there is no halfway house. The very nature of that rescue, the costly sacrifice of Jesus, declares it to be the only way of sacrifice. The only way of rescue. If there was any other way of overcoming the separation between God and people, any other way for us to have the joy of knowing God and sins forgiven, then God would not have sent his only son to die. He would have done it that other way, rather than send his son to die. As we see Jesus sweating drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane, as he recoils from the agony that awaits, as he prays that the hour might pass from him, take this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done. That tells us there is no other way, no other rescue. Christians are sometimes accused of being intolerant and arrogant when they talk about other religions. And maybe you think I've been arrogant this evening. I didn't mean to be. It's just that once you've discovered the truth about Christianity, it's hard to keep quiet. In fact, it would be a crime to do so. Imagine a scientist found the cure for COVID-19 right at the start, but she decided to keep quiet about it. She didn't want to boast. She wants to encourage others by making them feel that they are contributing something. She doesn't want to appear arrogant. Well, there would be an almighty outcry, wouldn't there? She found the answer to a global pandemic and didn't tell anyone. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands are dying. Of course, she would not remain silent. It's like that with the good news that Christians believe. Sometimes they might appear pushy and arrogant. Sometimes we Christians feel rather uncomfortable about it ourselves. But we only want to pass on good news. We can be forgiven. We can be right with God. We can be sure about it.